So help me welcome Sharon.
Bad. She's so bad. Bob got a much nicer introduction. Where's your host? Maybe he can come up here and do it for you. All right. Yeah. I'm Sharon Crane, alcoholic.
Hey, Sharon.
And yeah, it's been fun. Katie, she's a trip, you know. I get off the plane, we find each other, I get in the car, she says, "Tell me about your sixth year." I was like, you know, my 6 year of sobriety. I had to think about it a little bit, and we had a few talks about it, and you know, we're all in a state of growth and a state of grace today. So I think that's beautiful. One of the founders of where I work at this law firm says, "Well, you're going to either change or you're going to like irrelevance even less." And I really hate irrelevance. So one thing I don't want to be is irrelevant. I'm here. And but anyway, it's been great. I'm glad. Congratulations on 40 years, and that's awesome because Robert and I are both turning 40 this year, and we have a little more time than you, but. I'm a little more spiritual, but that's all right. You know, I love you, John and Kathy. You took care of my Jonas, my roommate, when I sent him out there, and you've taken such good care. And Lynn, thank you. Everybody, thank you for a great time. And I sure enjoyed doing the workshops with Steve and Bob. I learn a lot from those guys. I learn what to do. I learn not to do. And they give me a little insight into, you know, male alcoholics, and, you know, it's not... I'm glad I'm dealing with the women, that's all I have to say. Although my sponsor's a man, his name is Clancy, and I had women my first 10 years, and he wouldn't have worked one second sooner for me, I'll tell you that. But he said, "We'll try," and so we've been trying for 30 of my 40 years, and I guess it's working out, because I'm doing okay, and... Anyway, and I want to thank Patty and Elaine. I'll put Elaine in my car when I drive to work so I behave on the freeway. But I'm not sure about her. I heard a little bit about her. And then Patty, I got to meet her, and I can't wait to hear her because everybody said some great things. So, and I want to shout out to John Holmes because, you know, he does this. That's an old Carney thing. It means I'm with it. So when you used to walk the midway, instead of having him bark at you or try to get some money off you, just kind of give him the old on the side of the nose, and it means I'm with it. So John was always telling us he's with it, and I love that. I love that about him. Thank you for reminding me about that. And I spoke with Mary Emma, and, you know, she sends her love, and it's going to be hard. It's hard. You know, it's hard when we lose somebody that's been sitting in the front row, you know, leading the way for us, and just like... the seat's empty, and those of us that are that next generation are just being shoved right seat and all, right to the front row, and it's like, oh, no. But it's my responsibility, you know. I mean, Bill talks about, you know, spiritual awakening, that it's the greatest gift any of us can get is a spiritual awakening. And that's what we do for each other. We just help lead each other to each other's God and each other's spiritual awakening by using that simple kit of spiritual tools laid at your feet. And, you know, the bottom line is that nobody did it for me. I was that little girl. I never knew how to even thread a sewing machine. And I got an A in home ec because I'm a manipulator. Now, how do you make that buttonhole again? Would you show me? And so I had people do things for me, and, you know, so that I didn't have to do them. And then I wanted... you know, the grade or the trophy or whatever it was. And so I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, and you just lay those tools at my feet and said, "We'll show you how we use them, but we're not doing it for you." And thank God. Thank God each one of us have had our experience with each tool we pick up. And it is spiritual muscles. If you don't work them a while, it's hard. It's hard again. It's like working out again, and everything's sore and doesn't make sense. And so, you know, every day we have a daily reprieve, and I try to get my spiritual muscles working again every day, every day, every day. Because something happens when I go to sleep at night. That little space closes up. That little open space where my heart is open, my spirit is open, I'm teachable, I'm joyful. I mean, you can have joy even in pain, because joy is gratitude to me, and gratitude is grace. So even through all of the tough stuff, I've learned that I could pick up those tools and have them. And you've taught me how to use those. And so I carry those tools inside my heart, and I try to share my experience, strength, and hope, and that you will find your awakening, that I will have another awakening. Because every day I need to open that space up again, and every day I need accountability. And my sponsor, I know his number by heart. If you don't know your number, your sponsor's number by heart, learn it. You might be laying there somewhere without your cell phone. They say, who do we call? Oh, where's my phone? I don't know my sponsor's number. You know, we used to dial. We actually used to dial, you know. So I dial my sponsor every Tuesday afternoon at 3:30. And he puts Bob on hold so he can talk to me. But but I know his number by heart. And I've always known my sponsor's number by heart. And so I just ask you to do that little exercise if you want to. And so there I am, you know. Here I am, August 2nd. Yeah, 39 years, 11 months, and, gosh, 12 days. So in a few more days, if I stick around, 40 years. I'm only 49. How did that happen? You know, I drank in the womb, I guess. I don't know. but life is good today because I've been with you. You know, bridges have been mended. People have been saved. I've been saved. Ripples go out there with whatever I do every single day. Whatever we throw into the pond of life every day, it makes ripples. You know, and I used to go pick up the biggest clod of dirt I could and throw it in the pond of life and murk it up. So it's nice to be asked back. I was here before many years ago, and I was thinking, I wasn't even asked back to the Bastille in the French Quarter, which was a local bar, and it was off the beaten Bourbon Street path, so it was all locals in there. It was called the Bastille. And we painted the windows black so not an ounce of sunlight would get in there. And I would work at either the split shift or Fritzl's, or I'd be dancing at Chris Owens or wherever I was at that time. And I would, or the Lamplighter, that was another one. And I would go into the Bastille to start drinking because you had a tab at my bar, I had a tab at your bar. And I would go in there and I would start drinking. And if I passed out, Billy would put my purse under the bar so no one would steal my money. Or I would, you know, sometimes I'd pass out in the bathroom and have to get the key and pull me out. But then I could just kind of come to and start drinking again. And when I had 2 days off, that's where I stayed. I stayed in the Bastille. And the sunlight, you know, we just didn't let it in. And I got 86 from there. I got asked not to come back. And this was a real local joint. And I think it, you know, had something to do with my hair getting caught in the ceiling fan, dancing on the bar. Might have been, you know, getting sick somewhere and not cleaning it up. I came out of a blackout. I'm a blackout drinker. I didn't know that. I didn't know they called them blackouts. I just didn't remember, and everybody wanted to tell me about it the next day from high school on. You know, so I was a blackout drinker sometimes for days. And I remember coming to at the Bastille in a chug-a-lug contest in the middle of it, and I was in the finals. And we are drinking something called green chartreuse. And I don't know if you know that, but it's made by the monks, and it's green, and it's syrupy. And it's like, I don't know, it's like 180 proof. It's like intense alcohol in there. And I have a rock glass of green chartreuse I'm putting down my throat with this guy next to me who's big, and he's flying colors, so he's part of a gang, you know, some sort of a, you know, motorcycle gang. And there he is, there I am, and we're drinking our green chartreuse, and people are cheering. And so I kind of realize that they're cheering for me or him or something. They're cheering, and we're looking at each other and drinking this green chartreuse. And I get sick. But you're my type of alcoholics. You'll understand this. I got sick in the glass. A little bit sick in the glass. Because, you know, I'm determined. And I'm competitive. And I just slammed that puppy right back down my throat. And that's right. My kind of drinker's in here. I won the chug-a-lug contest. And I immediately went in the bathroom, and I don't know how long I was in there for, but that's the kind of drinker you got standing up here today. So as crazy and insane I was about drinking and the blackouts and the things got more violent as my drinking got more intense and alcohol, it wasn't my friend anymore. It wasn't, let's have a, you know, let's drink a bottle and go, you know, have a spiritual awakening, because that's what I got from a bottle. I had a spiritual awakening in a bottle. And it, why go to India and have a spiritual awakening? Why fast? Just go drink. It was so much better having that liquid spiritual awakening in a bottle. And it didn't do that for my friend Marianne or my friend Jeanette. They just drank and stopped drinking when they were done drinking. And sometimes we'd have some crazy times. This was in high school. And sometimes I'd drive them all home because I had a big capacity. And it was Iowa. It was state-controlled liquor stores. It was hard to get sometimes, but my dad had a business and he always had bottles. And those bottles would be watered down by me. Nobody told me to water them down. I just figured it out. Those bottles, every once in a while, there'd be one or two missing. I'd look at the things that have the dust on it and take those. And I always had a flask. I think I ruined my dad went hunting, so he would carry a flask because they always went hunting with flasks, I guess. And he was always missing his flasks, you know, because I would carry a flask. I carried a flask right, you know, in my boot. I carried a flask when I was out there. I would carry a flask a lot. So I always had something. I didn't like running out at all. And in we have a town drunk in Mount Vernon, Iowa. We don't have alcoholics. We don't know what alcoholism is. I have no idea. Nobody in my family is alcoholic that I know of. Could be somebody's going to fall out of the closet one day, but not yet. Nobody has. I did come from teetotalers, though, so who marched with Carrie Nation. And John Wesley is one of my relatives, and so they were behaving, I think. Some of them were behaving. So then there's me, and I'm the one that stood out. I'm the one that got in trouble. But I still made honor society. I still was a good artist. I still played a lot of instruments. I still was, you know, I was in pep band, polka band, concert band. Yeah, I played with the Boddicker Accordion Band, and we would play these festivals they had at these towns, whether it was Pork Day or Sauerkraut Day or... I know you guys got some Wickles Pickles here. You might have had a Wickles Pickles Day. And I would sit there on a hay wagon, on a hay bale, and maybe there's 12 of us in this band, and we're in a float. We're in a float in these little towns because it's a big deal and everybody's coming out. And you know, I remember my mother sold me, we had to wear these red dresses, these pique cotton dresses that would kind of cover the hay bales. But oh, it was always poking in my butt and I was always hungover. And we're sitting on this wagon and, you know, she's up there directing us and, you know, the whole town goes crazy for beer barrel polka or, you know, whatever. And there we are, and because I'm the middle child of three girls, and then my brother came last, my older sister's a Mensa, brilliant, four-year ride to an Ivy League school, got a master's, retired at 50, a millionaire, right? So that's a little bit of somebody to follow through it. And then my younger sister got the horse, the ponytail, and always had dad's eye. And she became a nurse and moved to Alaska, and my father loves Alaska, so he would visit her all the time. And then my brother's got a doctorate, so... Then there's me. So, you know, way back when I had that set up for myself, the middle child, I'm not enough. I have to compete. And when I couldn't, I just go drink because who cares? I'm already number one, you know. Omnipotence is what I got out of a bottle. It was just godlike. So there I am on that hay wagon, and I'm, you know, hungover. I've been dancing at Swisher with the boys from Iowa City the night before, and they had those, you know, V-neck sweaters, and they smelled like Jade East and English leather, and, you know, we would dance slow to the Righteous Brothers or whatever, and I would get really right up on them so I could smell if they got a little alcohol in their breath. Because if they had a little alcohol in their breath, they're my date for the night, because we, you know, out in the car, they had something to drink. My parents would drop me off. I was 14 years old. I would go dance. They would pick me up. I would be with the boys from Iowa City. I'd sleep in the back seat all the way home. Sharon must be tired from dancing. Nobody knew alcoholism. Nobody knew I was having a problem. And then I was on that hay wagon with that, you know, hangover. And there's those boys from Iowa City standing there in the, you know, in the crowd going, she was fun last night. What's with her today, you know? And corny, right? But we go around that corner, and there's my dad waiting for the float to come because he hears this coming, you know, Flight of the Bumblebee, Lady of Spain. And we go around that corner, and my dad sees me, and he gives me that thumbs up. And boy, I just waited for that. You know, I risked being uncool just for my dad to give me a thumbs up. And it was very worth it. It was very worth it. And by the time I was second year in college, my dad and I weren't speaking anymore. By the time I was second year in college, my dad and I couldn't sit down at a table together and me not instigate an argument, because I was a good instigator. I had had my heart broken, I cut my wrists, the priest came down with my dad, they talked to me at college. We ended up in a sit-in because we drank too many whiskey sours, me and the priest at dinner. So my father's standing at the door of the student union, and father and I are sitting in the middle of the student union protest sit-in. And, I mean, he's just thinking, oh my God, she's corrupted the family priest now. So my dad would try to help me. I mean, they sent me to psychiatrists. If you don't talk, they can't help. And I just thought, we're paying you, figure it out, buddy. I had a bad attitude. Bad attitude. And little did I know, I'm starting to set myself up to be a perfect victim, because that's what I was shooting for. And, you know, my dad, like I said, my dad didn't know what to do with me, and I gave him all the information, and I wouldn't let him help me. And I'm not hurting anyone but me, leave me alone. Boy, that's a selfish, self-centered cry. I'm not hurting anyone but me. Leave me alone. Stand back and watch me die. And that's what I said to everybody as I went down my path of drinking, which, you know, took me to New York to an ad agency, the Summer of Love. That was quite a summer. And they gave me a two-week vacation, and I left and never came back. And so I'm starting to take my geographics, and I want to go back to art school because New York City made me tired. It just made me tired. I was there about a year, and I was exhausted. And so I went back to college, and I drank a lot in New York because they close the bars at 4, they clean up, and they open back up. You know, and I'm a seeker. So I found a phrenologist to meet every Friday in the bar, and he would read the bumps on my head and tell me about my life, and then I would kind of move on for that week. I walked Central Park in the middle of the night with my flask, just daring people to come mug me. Well, eventually I got mugged. So, and then I went back to college to paint, and I couldn't paint. And that was really depressing because I used to be able to paint with oils, and now it's gone. And somewhere maybe at the Golden Rail or the West End Bar in New York City, maybe God would have said, talked through a bartender and said, you know, it's time if you're going to go down this path of alcoholism, you're going to have to give a few things up now. You know, so slide across your art talent, would you? And I would have said, yeah, take my art talent. I don't need it. Yeah, you know, I got new friends. I got things to do and sit around and paint. And after not cutting it at art school again, I had a big fight with my dad and ended up in Colorado where I wanted to be a cowgirl because I always wanted to be a cowgirl. And I worked at a restaurant where the owner taught me how to drink in the morning because I was always so sick from the Mountain Man bar the night before. And I waited on all the horse people. They would go have their rides, and then they would come in their equestrian clothes, and I waited on them. I never got on a horse. And I don't know if it was at the Mountain Man bar that, you know, God speaking through a bartender would have said, you know, it's time to give up another piece of your soul here as you go down the road of alcoholism. If it would have been so clear, I would have always picked King Alcohol, always. And God said, it's time to give up your dignity. Slide across your dignity now so we can have it. That's out of your camp. And so I met Bob Dylan, I think. It was Bob Dylan came to California, and I think it was. It's quite spiritual. And I end up at a commune where they asked me to leave because I'm the drinker. I drank the bong wine one night, didn't have anything to drink, and so, you know, they were really upset. Oh, good, there's a sick girl over here. I like it. So I end up, I don't know, working at the Sawdust Festival for a guy who painted pictures really fast, and he couldn't talk to people because he was always really doing everything really, really fast. Tiny pictures at this renegade art festival that we started for fun and for free, and I would sit in front, and I would talk to people. He bought me wine. All I had to do was, that was my job. He would buy me things to drink as long as he could, I could sell, and he was like Oz behind the curtain, you know, painting pictures, painting pictures, painting pictures, because he couldn't talk to people because it would just make him nervous, and they left. And so I would sit in front and sell his little paintings, and he would buy me wine, and that was heaven. That's all I had to do. But, you know, I'm restless, irritable, and discontent, so I ended up back in Colorado and back in Iowa, and I'm sick. I'm 21, and I'm sick. I have pancreatitis. I have a gallbladder non-functioning. I'm drinking in the taverns every night. I can't sit at the table and have breakfast, lunch, or dinner with my father. I can't sit. If he's in the living room watching TV, I'm not in there. My mother said, you can stay here. Please don't take any drugs and stay out of your father's way. And this is the little girl that wanted his thumbs up. So I drank, and I met somebody, and I went to another organic farm. I ended up with these organic. It must have been the big thing back then. But they were like hootenanny people, and they were mellow, and they didn't drink like me, and they drank little sips of dandelion wine at these hootenannies, and so thirsty, you know, so thirsty. And that banjo, he would learn to play that banjo, and he would miss a note, and I couldn't wait to drink so I could kick that banjo. And I would kick that banjo, and I would get my cheap wine or wild turkey or whatever I could afford, and they would, like, all leave because we don't like you when you drink. I'm always being asked to leave these holistic, peaceful situations because I'm the drinker, you know? And it was a lot of work, and I had this surgery, and I looked back, and the doctor said, you'd abuse alcoholic drugs. Look at you. You're 21. You shouldn't look like this. And that was in Eau Claire, Wisconsin, and I had surgery eventually, but he said, you shouldn't look like this. Do you abuse drugs or alcohol? I remember him asking me that, and I remember what I said, because I'm really good at it. I said, I'm organic. So, you know, they took out my gallbladder. I had to be on some medicine for the pancreatitis. I was really sick. But I was sipping my wine or drinking all the way through it, and eventually they left me to go do primal therapy because I wasn't spending. Somebody got some money, and they bought everybody primal therapy, and I said, just give me some money so I can get drunk and scream at the sheep. That's my primals, those organic sheep that were around. And so this is where my life kind of takes a turn with my mom. Now, my dad and I mean, they even sent me at the young kids' card tables at grandma's now at Thanksgiving when I go back for that. I'm not even at the big table anymore. And I don't belong to that family anymore. Look at this. They didn't know what to say to me. You know, I was either angry or sobbing or something. I was never, like, in the room with them. I wasn't the daughter that had all that potential that went to the White House when I was 16 years old. That was scary. I was a young citizen of America, you know. They picked 100 young citizens around the country that were the future of the country. I qualified for all the stuff above, but none of the other did they know. And, you know, I got drunk. I got drunk at that event. I got drunk. I was still tipsy going to the East Wing with Lucy Bird, Linda Bird, and Lady Bird having tea. I was tipsy. And I look back on it and said, wow, how disrespectful was I? Didn't matter. I met the boys from Virginia, and we were drinking. Didn't matter. So there I am. I'm leaving town because winter's coming. Nobody's here. I had this crop that we grew out in the middle of the forest, and I harvested it by horseback, and my friend Clarence would come, and he would bring wild turkey. He would bring the wild turkey, and he would come at night, you know, and he was an older farmer in the area, and he liked a little of my crop, and he would bring the booze, and I had this big upright pink piano. We had painted it pink, and I was playing. We would play Indian love songs, me and this guy with no teeth. you know, who was on a tractor because his license had been pulled for too many DUIs. So, my buddy. And then I think his wife took away the keys of the tractor and he didn't show up anymore, so. Mike likes that. I went to turn this into money and get out of town, and I forgot the stuff, and I turned around, and there was a Ferris wheel and a calliope, and I went, that's it. I always wanted to be a gypsy, so I had joined the carnival that night. And I packed up my stuff and left, and I called my mother from Arkansas. You know, I packed up a lot of hefty bags of crop in that station wagon, and some clothes, and told my dog to get in, and we became a carny. I got my little joint, because it was a shooting gallery, they called that a joint. And I got my flash, which were the teddy bears, and I learned a spee zeek zee zarny. Nobody told me how. I had to just listen. And, of course, we all stole, and we went into town 2 or 3 days and opened up and made money, and, you know, nothing's on the books. And then we go to another town, and, you know, I'm stealing whatever I want to steal. And I'm not thinking of amends. I'm not thinking that someday I'm going to have to make this right. I'm just loving being a gypsy. And I called my mother, and she said, you're what? You're where? And she started to cry. And it's like, come on, Mom. I can't even imagine saying that to my mother. Come on, Mom. I'm writing a book. It's another chapter in my book. She said, well, what about the antiques I gave you? What about the furniture I gave you? What about some of those things that, what about your cat? You have your dog with you, but where's the cat? Where's the horse? I don't know. Somebody will figure it out. My mother had to go up there quite a few times to get her things back, because I just left. But I'm not hurting anyone but me. Leave me alone. And that's what alcohol said to me. Just, who cares? Come on, I don't belong to that family anymore. So I just kind of stopped calling home. There were times that I needed something. My older sister would get me a plane ticket or whatever, but I just kind of stopped calling home. My mom always sent me something. On Valentine's Day, she would find me in whatever bar I was working at, and she would always send me a little check or some cash. And Christmas, she'd try to find me, too, with a little gift and cash. But I stopped going home. I stopped being part of that family. And I got busted for a felony in Bogalusa, Louisiana, for my crop, because the carnival was mad at me, I think. I started too many fights on the midway with my mace because I was not letting people win, and I didn't want to get rid of my teddy bears, and I was drinking tequila, and I didn't care. So you little boys, you know, if any of the little fathers had little boys in Arkansas and Louisiana and Mississippi and some of those Missouri, some of those other states back in 71, 72 that are all grown up now and didn't get their teddy bears, let me know. Definitely buy you a big teddy bear. So the owner fingered me. I know he did. And Matt Armstrong was his name. And they came kicking in the door because I kind of cracked it open at 6 a.m. in Bogalusa, Louisiana, some cheap, seedy motel where we always stayed anyway. And I, you know, stood up against the wall, and they searched the room and found everything. So I went to jail, and my dog went to jail, and the new love of my life, I met with a carnival, because that's where they are, girls, with all that potential. And he went to jail, and he had a pet skunk named Crank who went to jail. So we all went to jail. And they would, like, make fun of us. And I was in this front holding cell with this other woman because they didn't know what to do with me. And they didn't give me my rights, and I screamed for my rights, you know, because I'm a 60s protester. I know what the law is, and, you know, and they didn't care, and they finally typed them up and handed through the bars and said, shut up. And after a couple of days, they let me have a phone call, and I, because the carnival, where are they? They didn't come back. I'm, you know, surprise, surprise. And somewhere was that guy I was with. He was at the male holding cell, and I'm at the female holding cell, and I called my brother-in-law in New York, who's a lawyer, and he said, whoa, I don't know anything about Louisiana law. But he had called my father and my mother and told them what had happened. And I didn't call my father and mother. After being in there about a week, they took me in this room, and there sat my dad. I'm handcuffed. I'm crazy. I'm detoxing. I'm having DTs. They're coming in at night. I'm cutting myself with this Coke bottle, so I have little cuts all over me, so because the blood would keep people away, I thought, because I was crazy. And they would come in at night and take their pick, and they left me alone. She's crazy. And I needed alcohol. That's what I needed. And there sat my dad, and I hope you have a day that you remember that you never want to forget. I never want to forget that day, because I sat there, and all of a sudden I looked to my left, and there's my dad. Oh. You know, he had to get on a plane, he had to bring his checkbook, he had to rent a car, he had to hire this lawyer, he had to hire a bail bondsman. And we didn't look at each other that day. We didn't hug that day. I made a lot of amends to my dad, you know, financial, emotional. When I was 20 years sober, I talked to my dad about that day. And, you know, how we are. He's sitting at the end of a dock, and my sponsor, Clancy, I said, you know, I never talked to my dad about that whole event there, and I don't remember it. Maybe there's some more amends in there I need to make. And he said, well, you'll know the right time when it's the right time to talk to him about that. You've been sober a long time, and he knows you're okay now. But I'm so glad I've been guided through my amends process by not going home and ripping off scabs. Oh, yeah, I'm sorry for this. Oh, yeah, I'm sorry for that. And no, and let's leave somebody in a lot of pain because they have no way to deal with all of that. I've been walked through it very lovingly with patience. And I've had to have perseverance, which is huge for me, consistency, be responsible. Those things were all, I learned so much of that through amends. So when he was 20 years sober, he was sitting at a dock on a lake, and I thought, maybe today's the day. I was visiting. I was back home, and I walked down, sat down, and he put his book down, and he looked at me, and I said, hey, Dad, you remember that time that you had a... Of course he did. He's just like, we laughed about that for a minute. You know, that was a good lead-in. And he said, yeah. I said, what did I say, and what happened, and... So we talked about it, and he told me what, you know, all of that was in my financial amends. I had made financial amends for that money he spent. But all of that emotional stuff hadn't come out yet, and we talked about it, and it was, we laughed a lot. And he said, you know what, I was kind of almost proud of you. You only said two things the whole time to that lawyer and that bail bondsman and me, and it was, I am not guilty, and it is not my fault. Anytime they asked me that, I said, I am not guilty, and it is not my fault. And I believed it. I believed it. So there I am. I get out. They told me they shot my dog. I found my dog. It was crazy. It was a really insane time, and I thought, how did I get here for a moment until I had a drink? And then, oh, look where I am. I'm in the French Quarter in New Orleans. Yeah. 24/7 town. Love it. And that was my base for the next 3.5 years. And it got darker, and I had to push across more pieces of my soul across the bar when I was asked by King Alcohol to stay in the game. I had to put, you know, we had to push over people that we loved who would die sitting next to me on a bar stool. People's, you know, livers blew up. People got shot because they were, the, you know, bullet was for the person sitting next to them, but they got shot. People would get stuck somewhere way far away and would end up in the hospital beaten up. And, you know, things got darker and crazier. And I just drank. And I drank in more seedy places and more seedy places and more seedy places. So my last job, I got fired for having a bad attitude. You could smell the bathroom walking in the front door. And even my alcoholic drinking buddies who were bartenders too didn't want to drink with me. Hey, you got a tab, come find me. Once in a while I would. And I said yesterday in our workshops that two of those women I hung with, we were the Three Musketeers, they're sober today. Three of us are sober. It's pretty phenomenal. And Denny went back to law school. She owned the bar, and then she went sober and joined the bar. So went from the bar to the bar. She researched my felony for me and got me on a general pardon for fun and for free. So I just, you know, I passed the TSA background check, and it was good. It's not on there. And I just, like I said yesterday, I just saw my Social Security, and that carnival guy that I was with, his name is, my name was his name on this Social Security report. I don't know if we went to a justice of the peace. I have no idea. But the guy said, we don't go back that far. Don't worry about it. So, okay, I won't worry about it. So that was scary to just see that pop up. I'm a blackout drinker. I don't know. Maybe we did get married somewhere. I have no idea. But that's when my dad and mom came to visit me. They were in Texas, and they came over to see if daughter was okay because they didn't know where I was, living above a tar paper roof apartment. It was three of us above a biker bar called the Mousetrap. Really insane place. And there's my dad standing at the door because he won't come in. His daughter has a black eye with glitter done. The drag queens would show me how to do my face up with glitter to hide the black eyes with stars and shooting blue glitter. So I had glitter on my face. I had my platinum blonde wig on. I had my fishnet stockings. I had my zipper outfits and my platform shoes because I was just getting home. And there's my dad and my mom, who had tears in her eyes, and that's kind of what I remember. And, you know, my dad wouldn't come in, and this guy put the snake in his face because we have snakes, too. It's crazy. The snake got out. We never found it again. Somebody found it and took it to Florida, and it got freedom. So my dad couldn't come in. He couldn't look at me, and my mother cried. And my father was killed in 99 and on his land in a freak accident. And we were sitting around it. It was when that happened, we were sitting around at a dinner, the family, and we're talking and laughing about stuff. And my brother started talking about that place I lived in the French Quarter. I thought, well, you never visited me when I lived there. And he said, well, yeah, we came with Mom and Dad when they came over from Texas. They were littler. I was like, oh, you guys were there? He said, yeah, that jerky boyfriend was always harassing you, and I just wanted to punch his lights out, but I was smaller than him. And my sister said, yeah, we went out to get some food, and he showed me where to go, and he followed me, and he took me in some girly show like it was going to freak me out. I didn't even know they were there. So I'm a blackout drinker, and if every single day of my life I have the privilege of rubbing out the record by being part of the force for good, as it says on page 77, my real purpose that gave me so much freedom when I found that, because I am a blackout drinker, and I need to make amends every single day to the world. If there's something specific, I will. But I know there's places and people I hurt that I will never, ever know. And so I get to fit myself every day to be of maximum service to God and the people about it. So I walk out at lunch and I smile at people. I just walk out at lunch and I smile at people. And they smile back. And lately, people have been smiling at me first. It's kind of weird. Because I talk to people in elevators, I'm friendly, the shoe man knows me, he won't even charge me anymore for my shoes. I said, please take some money. He said, no, you help me. It's like, oh. We're examples of the grace of God. We are examples of the grace of God. And I don't break man into me where I work, but there's been times people have come to me. So maybe the word is kind of underground. I don't know, but somebody will use a word like, I put a chip in my dad's coffin. Whoa. So I'll find her later and go, what are you talking about? Well, my brother's sober in Texas in AA. And for some reason, we were in the girls' bathroom and I told her a little bit about myself. And then about a year later, I'm sitting at my desk one morning, I smell her coming. She's in her black cocktail dress from the night before, having a good time, coming to work in her black cocktail dress. I get that. The advertising agency we used to, whatever, nobody cared. It was creative. And and they had two-hour martini lunches every day. It's just like Mad Men. I loved it. So there she was, and she said, I'm ready. So you never know who's watching. You never know what kind of an example you're being out there. So every single day I get to go out at my own chair, I have the privilege of smiling at people. So my life has changed greatly. I came to you on August 20th, 1975, because I was on my way to Hawaii from New Orleans, and I never made it. I never made Hawaii until I was 20 years sober. And I ended up in Palm Springs on the back of a Harley having a good time in my red dashiki, my Panama hat, my backpack. with my book called Be Here Now by Baba Ram Dass that I carried around with me forever. And all my dogs have, you know, hit the grave one way or the other. And I've made my amends to the animal kingdom too, over and over and over again. And if you were sponsored by me and you were whining, I'll make you go rescue a cat. You need something to love. Go rescue a cat. If you can't have a dog, go get a cat. And I've always had rescue animals, and they find me. They find me. And they're my accountability in the morning. When I sit down and I have my meditations, they're already there. My dog has a command called meditate. They're all on the couch waiting for me because they know after we do whatever we got to do and listen to whatever we got to listen to, we're going to eat. So have to have accountability. So I end up beaten up. I end up at some place. I am 175 pounds of bloated, toxic, alcoholic mess with my Panama hat, my liver spots on my face. I got fired from a place in La Cienega being a cocktail waitress the first night halfway through because I couldn't remember where the drinks went. I am like burnt out. I am 25 and burnt out. And I don't care anymore. I don't care anymore. So there I am in some situation when the bar is closed where I end up with people I don't know and I come to in an empty apartment and I'm getting abused and beaten up and my jaw's broken in three places and my nose is broken. I have a concussion and, you know, I mean, it was just, there was a detective involved because they caught these people and I had to go to court and I was in a blackout and it was crazy. But I ended up in the hospital, and I ended up on a gurney that morning. It happened on July 27th, 75, and my sobriety date's August 20th. And I ended up on a gurney that morning, and I can't talk, of course. And they're asking me who I am, and I'm writing my name, and I see a word in front of my name. It says victim. Yes. Yes. It says victim. There it is in black and white, and that's what this Daddy's girl, loved God, God loved me, had a great upbringing, a lot of potential, a lot of God's talent, a lot of ways to make a useful life, and I drank it all, I gave it all to King Alcohol, and I'm shooting for victim. I'm shooting for victim, and I got it. I'm in the hospital 2 weeks, and a guy that I had met at Barney's Beanery said I could come stay with him, which is a bar in West Hollywood where I first saw the Big Book on the bar. She was really drunk. I thought, Alcoholics Anonymous. She had the Big Book, and she was going to get her card signed. So we cheered her and out the door with my Jose Cuervo, good for you, Chris, go to AMA. You know? And I was staying with this guy, and on August 20th, he said, you know what, you're depressing me. You have to leave. I was like, oh, God. And this is my day. And we've all had our day, our moment of grace that gets us here on the seat. Each one of us have that day. And it's priceless, priceless. And I call my mom, who didn't know where her daughter was because she didn't know what hospital I was in after she got a phone call. For 2 nights, my mother didn't sleep. My mother sleeps at night because of Alcoholics Anonymous. Thank you. So she said, I can't help you anymore. Go to the Salvation Army. And having my ears open and listening and being awake, last year my mother started talking about the time that her husband, my dad, Frank, said no to her to helping one of her children. She said, there was only one time in my life where Frank said to me, I can't help one of my children. And she was 94 then, and she likes to tell little stories. It's fun to hear a lot of things. And somebody was going to, I just thought, there's a room full of people. We're not going there. So I changed the subject, and the next day I talked to my mom. I said, Mom, what were you talking about the time that Dad said no to you? It was that day. My mother had to put the phone to her chest so I couldn't hear. My mother had to ask my dad if they could help me because I was in a big jackpot. And my dad said no. My mother got back on the phone, and here is my life hung in the balance. My mom said, we can't help you anymore. Go to the Salvation Army. $20, you'd have another speaker. Norm Alp used to talk about seconds and inches. Each one of us have our seconds and inches that get us here. So my mother carried that around with her until last year. Wow, I'm so glad we got to talk about that. So I called the girl that was dating the guy I was staying with. Her name was Chris, the girl in the bar with the big book having to get her court card signed. But I don't relate any of that. Her number's just there, and I call her, and she answers. And she can't help me, but a woman, Suzanne, can, because she said, later, I was drinking. I couldn't come get you. I was drinking. And so I called the stranger that I never do, and I have this wired jaw. You know, I can't talk. I've got wires all over holding this. I got a lot of wire in me. I don't ring off TSA. I don't ring off the thing, but you know, if you look at an x-ray, I got a lot of wires in my jaw, putting it back together because it was off. And I didn't have any feeling for a long time, and I couldn't touch my cheekbones for about a year. And I was just, I was really beaten into some sort of surrendered desperation because I'm a fighter. I'm a fighter when it's time to survive, and I got myself out of a lot of situations. And I just stopped fighting because I was tired. Blessedly, beautifully tired of all of it. And I called this woman, Suzanne. I can't talk. She knew the liquor store I was at because everybody knew that liquor store, and I was living above it. She said, go sit down, put your drink down, put your joint down. Oof, what's she talking? How's she know? You know, and just getting my attention, giving me orders, and I went and sat on those steps, and this car pulled up, and it was bright yellow, and it was like, oh, no, it's too bright, and these girls got out that were too bright, and I didn't like them, and I don't know where I'm going. I just need a place to stay because I have to go back to Palm Springs to court. I know that, and I've got this stuff on my face, and I know that doctor's going to take it off in 3 months. I was like that, so I couldn't talk when I came to you, which was a blessing. People would walk by me, and nobody asked what happened to you. I had this newspaper clipping in my pocket from Palm Springs, you know. They're just, oh, God, you look tired. Maybe take off your backpack and stay with us. Because I was always walking around with my backpack, and because I'm ready to go at any moment, you know. But I'm blessedly tired. Sitting with you was one of the most comfortable things I had had in a long time. When I heard my sponsor laugh in the back of the room, I realized I felt safe. I hadn't felt safe in a long time. And I ended up at a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous because these girls took me and talked incessantly about themselves and put me in this church where I think, okay, I'm going to have to tell them I don't really believe in God, and no, I'm not going to join your parish, and don't baptize me. And I was going to really have to do all of that, I thought. And then I heard the guy say, because I'm the little girl looking for the mothership, as I talked about yesterday in the workshop, I'm the little girl looking for the mothership. And the guy said, he always waited for the mothership to land and say, you can come home now, Bill. Spaceship people. And that's where I went, until a guy named Maurice Zolotow came and gave me this book and wrote my name in pencil. He got my name out of me, wrote where I was, and wrote the date in pencil. I still have that second edition big book in pencil with his writing. And I gave him a quarter a week until I paid off that book, because I'm not going to owe you anything. I'm keeping a list. Some man saw me writing down another ride I got with hashtags. Another ride I got. You know, $20 from someone, pack of cigarettes from someone. Somebody gave me a dress. And a man walked up to me, and he saw what I was doing. He said, Sharon, put that away. Now I still can't talk, so he just said, put that away. Someday you're going to have a car with a driver's license, insurance, and registration all in the same name, he said. How does he know that? And you're going to be able to have somebody sleep on your couch. You're going to be able to give newcomer rides. You're going to be able to clean out your closet and help somebody starting a new job, and take them out to the car after the meeting and take them out of your trunk and cleaner bags and give them some nice clean clothes for their new job. I thought, how did he know that? His wife did that for me so she wouldn't embarrass me at the meeting. I thought, well, how does he know that? And he said to me, he gave me back, he slid across to me some dignity. He said, someday, Sharon, you're going to have all that and you're going to be able to pass it on. That's the way we want to be paid back. Do it for somebody else when you have it. And he slid back a lot of dignity and hope to me that day. And that's what I've been doing ever since, is trying to pass it on and be hope for the new person or the person who needs it. Or, you know, think about my 6 years and help little Miss Katie out here. And she's not in that much trouble, just a little. But my girl Dottie's here from Memphis, and I started working with her. I love sponsorship. Thanks for coming over. You too, Michelle. I love sponsorship. I learned so much about God and sponsorship. So much. It's about just trying to help you get a bigger God. That's it. So if I'm helping you, boy, I'm helping me get a bigger God. Little did I know, this broken, beaten up piece of almost trash came in Alcoholics Anonymous and you've given me a huge, beautiful life. Huge. You know, I got married. My dad walked me down the aisle. He came to our meeting. He stood up as Frank Meyer from Upward in Iowa. I'm here to give my daughter away in marriage. And he stood up at our home meeting and said that. And nobody yelled at him to sit down, you're not an alcoholic. You know, they just said, hey, Frank. And at the end of that wedding day, my dad and I were eye to eye. And he was saying, Sharon, look at your life. These people are great. If you think twice about what you think twice, if you're going to go back out, you think twice about what you're doing because you've got it made here. And that was my dad's little talk to me. Eye to eye, somebody snapped a picture. Yeah, he's a reader, so when it was time for me to make financial amends at 5 years when I got a better job, he was ready. Ran the calculator tape, put it in the big book. He was ready. And that sponsor I had, Jenny, she said, make sure you don't be late with that check and put a note about your life, because she wanted one more thing from me. Those sponsors just, they have some experience. They just want one more little piece of you that makes all the difference. So that when my dad called me at 5 years, about 5 years sending that check, you know, he said, Merry Christmas, I don't want your money anymore, but don't stop sending me your notes. And we healed. Forgiveness was all right there. It was great. It was bigger than me. It was bigger than anything I expected to happen. So when my dad was killed, it was, we were good. And we had been good. And I sent my son home every summer to Grandpa and Grandma's in Iowa so he can learn how to use a hammer, weed a garden, drive a go-kart, you know, swimming lessons, ride a horse. You know, he went home, and then when I think he was about 14, my mom said, I don't think you need to send him anymore. He had kind of outgrown a little bit of that, but my son has Midwest ethics. My son has good ethics. He grew up in L.A., but when I meet people who work with him, they go, wow, he just doesn't seem like an L.A. kid. I said, got a lot of grandpa and grandma in him, yeah. And he just stopped by from his way home from Europe to see grandma in Madison, because that's where she lives now. So I'm finally from the state of cheese. It's a little more dignified than pigs and corn in Iowa, so... So Clancy became my sponsor when I went to pick up my Jenny at the airport, and she had 21 days instead of 21 years getting off the plane from Paris, smoking pot in Paris. And they told her, you can take your cake, Jenny. Don't worry about it. And Jenny said, I knew better. There was a priest in our group that went over there for something, and he stopped by Paris to see Jenny, and Jenny told on herself, and she came home. And she drank again, and she eventually got sober. She had 11 years when she died. But I had to get a new sponsor because my life was so falling apart, and my ex was dating the newcomer in the back of the room. He wasn't my ex yet, he was my husband. So it was a little dicey. Drippy today. Anyway, so Clancy became my sponsor because I was in trouble. And you know, he saw me one night, going to throw hot coffee on him, because they were pregnant and getting married in that order, and he said, you'll walk through this with dignity and grace, and then he added that little extra that sponsors do, so you can be an example to others. Ugh, I don't want to be an example to her. I joined the baseball team. I re-upped because the sober softball team, played her sober softball team, and she's a lefty, and I'm first base, so you know where all her balls went, right? Right to me. Do you know who never missed one of her balls? I had bruises to show it. I mean, I'd leap in front of that ball if I had to. She never got on base with me. And he told her, they were married a year, the baby was a year and a half old when he left for somebody else. And so she said, you know what, Sharon, I knew I could do it because I'd watched you. So, you know, Chuck C's right. Love is 1,000 to nothing. I don't get to judge who gets my love. It's 1,000 to nothing. And Chuck used to talk about it rains on the just and the unjust, so everybody gets a chance. And she had watched me walk through it. And we're good friends. She'll give me a cake the end of August at my women's meeting. We do Mother's Day together with our kids. They come over Christmas night, and we laugh and play charades, and we're family. He's not. He's somewhere else, way in the West Coast in Nevada, somewhere else. He's sober, but he doesn't go to meetings. He doesn't have a relationship with his kids for years. We raised my kid. We did a good job. Thank you. When I needed a male influence, I just take him to the yard, and somebody like Frank Jones would tell him war stories and teach him how to hit a volleyball. And, you know, it's like there was male influence on him over there, and he became a good volleyball player because of that. And my dad, that was a hard day. I got off the plane, and AA was at my mom's house. Thank you. 1 year, 1 month, and 14 days later, but who's counting, I started dating a man named Casey, who I watched come into Alcoholics Anonymous. And I always thought he was handsome, but I'm married. Now, I'm a loyal Leo. I'll hang on your leg all the way out the door if we're not done yet. You know, I mean, you're going to have to shake me off. I'm better now. I don't go into the point where it hurts me being that loyal, but loyalty is a good thing. And so Casey and I started dating, and I told Clancy, and, you know, Clancy was like such a dad, well, don't sleep with him. And it's like, I'm not going to sleep with him. You know, it's like, we're going to date. And we dated, and, you know, I have my son there who's throwing spaghetti at the wall as we're going out on our dates. And I'm thinking, oh, this isn't going to go. But as I didn't get in their way, because one day he said to me, you know, you don't let us have our own relationship. Every time I'm playing Legos with him, you come out of the kitchen to show us how to play Legos correctly. Something, I'm doing something with him, and you come and tell me how you do it with him. So I had to learn how to hang onto the sink when they were playing Legos or doing something, playing video games. I had to hang onto the sink and let them have their own relationship, and they grew into it. They grew into it. And my husband helped Casey help Wesley a lot with his school and his papers and things like that, and how to start a business. My son started a business. And that man, we were great partners. I think if you're married to somebody in Alcoholics Anonymous, you could be great partners, great separate, but great partners, greater partners, more effective. And we were. And, you know, he passed away 4 years ago. You know, he's a big golfer, and he always had stuff burned off him, but, you know, something called a spore of malignant melanoma got inside, and that was it. And, you know, that's a day you sit at the oncologist, and they go, God, well, what's going to happen now? Because we thought we got it, it came back. He said, well, you have about 7 months. That's a day. And we both looked at each other and said, he said 7 years, right? That's a day we had to invite God in. And we did a lot of traveling. We had 2 years and 2 months because we found a clinic that gave him trials. And he didn't feel good, but we were on planes to Ireland and Scotland and Sweden and Australia, Virginia, South Dakota, New York. And he didn't feel well, but he showed up every Wednesday in his seat, and he made a difference. He made a difference. And my heart's been broken open, and it's healing bigger. Because he was my soulmate. And beautiful, joyous passing with Alcoholics Anonymous in the room, a Buddhist and a nun, and we had it all covered, and a golf club and a blues picker, and we had it all covered. And it was peaceful and beautiful, and I miss him every day, but he's been working on that foursome up there with Sandy and Frank Jones and a lot of people that I love that are gone. Now he's got John up there. John's probably teaching him how to play tennis, you know. We're being shoved to the front row generation, you know. We got to be responsible. We got to say yes to Alcoholics Anonymous. We got to show up. We got to keep it going here. We got to keep the fire lit, bright, lit. Because this is the only thing that has not just helped alcoholics stay sober, but that has given us a brand new life. I want to let you know that my dad read the big book, and this town drunk came over and said to him, you know, my wife is giving me a hard time. I'm here to borrow a bottle. And my dad said, "You're an alcoholic. It's not Mary's fault. It's helped my daughter, Alcoholics Anonymous. Maybe it'll help you." And he gave him the book to read. I didn't know this until my dad's already gone. My mom told me this. And I was speaking at a meeting a couple years after my mom told me that. For some reason, I mentioned it. His name is John. I said, my dad 12-step a town drunk called John. And his niece was in the meeting in California. This is from Lisbon, Iowa. And she came up to me after. She said, "Wow, do you know who I am?" And I thought, "Well, you look kind of familiar." She said, "You know, her name is Lizzie. And that's her Uncle John." "Oh, yeah, he used to babysit me. Oh, God, I smoke pot. Are you okay? I'm sorry." Mormons, they just come out of the woodwork. And she said, "My Uncle John's still sober. I went home for a family reunion 2 years ago, and he 12-stepped me, and I have 2 years. I got to see the ripple hit the shore. We don't always get to see what joins up and where the ripple hits the shore. But I got to see it, feel it, experience it, have more God that day. I just say yes. I do what I can, and I say yes." And, you know, Casey, we're sitting there. I'm going to end with this story. We were sitting there one morning, and he's doing treatment, and his guys are taking him, and, you know, he's not eating his breakfast, and it's a hard day. And I don't want to be the taskmaster. You got to eat your oatmeal, you know. I was trying to be a wife through this. It was hard. And I said, "I don't see God in this." He's like, "I'm complaining, right?" He's going off for more stuff, more juice, he called it. And he said, "You know what, I don't either, Sharon. Sometimes I really don't either." And we're kind of quiet, and the wind is blowing outside, and he looks at me and he said, "Look outside, Sharon, do you see the wind?" And I was like, "Yeah, I see the wind. They're blowing things around out there." And he said to me, "No, Sharon, do you see the wind?" And I watched Kung Fu. I'm feeling this is Grasshopper Sensei moment going on right here. I better pay attention. I better pay attention. And I looked outside again, and I said, "No, I don't physically see the wind." And he said, "Yeah, that's right. We see the effects of the wind, right?" I said, "Yeah." He said, "Well, that's kind of like me and God, you know. I look around and what's going on and what I have to go through and all that. I don't see God in all of this. I don't. It's hard. But I go out of this door every single day and I go look for the effects of God." And that's what I've been doing. And there's a lot of God in this room today. And we're just going to be wheels down when we go home. We've been flying high. It's just wheels down on the tarmac. Take it home. Take it to the world. Don't forget what we're about. One alcoholic talking to another alcoholic. Don't forget to guard their traditions. And I'm going to go home, and my dog is going to be so happy to see me. If you don't have a God, get a dog, because you know what dog spelled backwards is. And when we come to God, God treats us like this. He treats it like, "I'll open my door, and my dog will go, 'You're home, you're home, you're home, you're home. So glad to see you. I've been waiting for you.'" And that's how my God is every single day when I go sit with my God. You can go to the mailbox, come back. "You're home, you're home, you're home, you're home." I have a couple cats just to go, "Yeah, yeah, she's here, who cares, you know." I am humbled how much you've given me. I am humbled by how my life is. I am humbled how God uses me up. And that's what Blake said when he was sitting on the Ganges River. He saw all the pyres of life going down and he didn't know what it was all about. And he asked one of the locals there in India, I said, "What's going on?" He said, "Well, these are pyres of life. We have certain times of the year that we can put our dead, and not year, but month, because, you know, they put them in the linens and we put them, all the things they loved in the boat, and we make a ceremony and we light it on fire and we send it down the Ganges. Tonight's one of those nights you're seeing all these lives." And he thought a minute and he said, "Wow. When they put me on the pyre life, may I be all used up." So I hope I go home and try to become half the person my dog thinks I am. Thank you, Atlanta, for having me.